Welcome to Living Planet. My name is Neil King. And this week we have a compelling story from our friends at What on Earth, a CBC podcast dedicated to bringing you a world of climate solutions. Now, in Canada, a sure sign of autumn is the so-called Salmon Run, which sees tens of thousands of fish fighting to return to their spawning grounds. Quite possible that you've seen some of these pictures in a documentary. They are very impressive. And it's never an easy journey for the salmon, but in recent years, indigenous communities have been sounding the alarm over the especially dire state of Chinook salmon. That's a keystone species that is also sacred to many First Nations. Now, the so-called salmon people are fighting to make sure these mighty fish make it home.
Now we're going to pop it open. Ready? And then, there, look. You see that salmon in there?
Yeah.
That's a lot of salmon.
It's dinner time for James McDonald, his wife Roxanne, and their two children. Their son, Cy, has just been helping his dad open a can with the main ingredient.
You guys like salmon, right?
Yeah.
Why do you like salmon?
Because it makes the bones strong.
That's right. And it tastes yummy.
It's a lovely family scene, but what's important to note here is what's not on the menu, fresh salmon. Instead, the can contains salmon caught and processed far, far away.
My wife and I were down at Costco a couple of weeks ago in Vancouver, Richmond, and we bought $300 worth of canned sockeye. And, you know, it's the only way at this point that we can have salmon in our house.
The only way, and that's because James lives in Whitehorse. And despite his First Nations ancestors having fished for Chinook for millennia, he can't. The salmon in the nearby Yukon River are on the brink of disappearing altogether. So flying south for tinned salmon is one of the few alternatives.
Daddy's going to give you a spoon to try, okay?
We can still maintain some kind of diet of salmon in our house that way. It's not the preferred method. Culture doesn't come from a can, but, you know, when we prepare it with the kids, we can still talk to them about it. We can still tell them about, you know, what salmon means to us and how grateful we are to have salmon in our household, because not everybody can afford that.
I'll get a spoon now. Can you give me a spoon, please?
Okay, just grab a little bit of the end. You can eat it.
And just to pop in here again, I'm Laura Lynch, and this is What on Earth, where we bring you a world of climate solutions. This week, we went to the Yukon as part of a special project we're calling Overheated. It's a joint effort between What on Earth, Quirks and Quarks, and White Coat Black Art to examine the impact of climate change and heat. Canada's north is warming faster than the rest of the country. The summer temperatures in Whitehorse this year peaked at 30 degrees. Smoke from wildfire was hanging over the stunning mountain ranges. We wanted to see what that heat is doing to the people and to a particular species considered a cultural keystone for First Nations.
This is my office. That's my art. This is from...
Let's get back to James, who's showing me around his home, including some Indigenous prints hanging on the wall.
Are those Chinook or...?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
As you can see, my kids and...
Yes, your major job of dad.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. I spend a lot of time with those two.
James, besides spending a lot of time being dad, has worked on the Yukon Salmon Subcommittee appointed by the federal government. He also works for the Assembly of First Nations in Yukon in fisheries. Now, James and his family are citizens of one of the First Nations in the southern Yukon, the Ta'anquachan Council. So his mission to save the salmon goes beyond the strict confines of his work.
Yeah, you know, when I think of salmon, I think of a way of life. I think of linkages to the past. I think of a whole host of cultural practices, beliefs, set of systems, ways of thinking, ways of doing. It's a whole fabric of a lifestyle that, you know, that's what salmon means to me. It's in our art, it's in our language, it's in our diet, it's in our homes, it's in our stories, it's in our graves.
It's in your graves? What do you mean by that?
Well, it's people identify themselves as salmon people. Many First Nations have specific stories that speak to salmon and salmon culture. So, you know, for us, it's a way of life. And part of that is passing away. And so it's in our graves as well.
Because of dwindling runs, many First Nations in the Yukon voluntarily stopped fishing for Chinook years ago. James himself hasn't fished for king salmon, as they're also called, since he was a young boy. Now the species is in such a dire and dangerous position that Canada and Alaska just imposed a 7-year ban on fishing of the Chinook.
I would say it's a deep well of sorrow to not be able to share that joy with my family. Because it was a wellspring of joy to be able to go out there every day and fish for salmon and eat salmon and be part of salmon culture. And my kids don't have those opportunities. We can't fish right now. We're trying to conserve and protect salmon. And we're doing our part to promote that conservation mentality in the hope that in the years to come, they will return in a plentiful amount such that we can fish again.
James acknowledges the role First Nations have played in the species' decline, though he says they're not the biggest factor. And he supports the ban to let the salmon rest.
Let the salmon recover for a 7-year period, which is accepted as the life cycle of a salmon. And in that intervening time, what we're aiming to do is create a rebuilding plan, both a domestic one, but also an international one with our Alaskan counterparts, but also look at ways that we can research what's happening, identify the gaps in knowledge, identify resources that we know we need based on that work. What exactly that is, we don't know yet, but it's a pause for now.
Now, there's a few things you should know about salmon. They are remarkable creatures. Their eggs hatch in creeks. They grow and travel to the ocean, transitioning from fresh to salt water, changing color at the same time. And then, years later, they somehow know it's time to return to the same spot where they were born in order to die. But that happens only after the next generation's eggs are nestled among the rocks in the creeks.
I kind of think of them as celestial. They're just there. They know what to do. It's hard to kind of describe that mysticism, that celestial, not ability, just like this being that has been there for millions and millions of years. And my hope is that they'll be here for another million more.
And now here's a part of all of that that's special to these Yukon River Chinook. They do all of that I just talked about, but the journey up to 3,200 kilometers is the longest salmon migration in the world. And with climate change, that journey has become ever more perilous. What you're hearing are the glacier-fed waters of the Yukon River as they rush toward Whitehorse at Miles Canyon. The undulating walls were created by a volcanic eruption and lava flow millions of years ago. The water swirls and swells between the crevices as it pushes forward, and the salmon used to pass here in big numbers in August. Hundreds of thousands crossed the Alaska-Yukon border. This year, there aren't any in sight. In fact, there's been a big drop-off. Just 15,000 crossed last year. Elizabeth McDonald, no relation to James, is a biologist and a fisheries manager for the Council of Yukon First Nations. She, like James, marvels at the epic nature of the salmon's journey.
It's definitely a marathon that they do to their spawning area, so it's about 2 months of not eating and then the human equivalent of running uphill. So they're swimming uphill against the current. And yeah, it's absolutely a marathon, and they do that with no food, smelling their way home, essentially.
But Elizabeth says effects of climate change may be like adding headwinds to the marathon, with warmer water contributing to the problem.
There's a lot of speculation around what part of the ocean that is affecting them the most, but I think it's that early life stage. And what we're seeing from the warming waters is it's changing the food that's available to them out there.
Much of this is now the subject of scientific study, but she says a warming sea seems to have changed the marine ecosystem. That means there's less of the salmon's usual diet of smaller fish or krill, for example, during the years that it's living in the Bering Sea. And that's food that is crucial for the salmon to prepare for its marathon.
So it's going from, say, more of a fish diet to something with more like jellyfish or something, and these have less nutrients in them. But at the same time, the warming water is increasing their metabolism. So now they're eating food with less nutrients, but they actually need more energy because the temperature has come up and their metabolism with it. So their energy demands are increased. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword where they need more food, but they're getting less quality food.
So the salmon become fully grown, needing all the energy they can to make it back upriver, yet unable to eat the kind of protein-rich, calorie-rich food required. Then there's the ick factor. It's a parasite, which can invade and do damage when the fish are already in a weakened state.
Out in the ocean, when you have warmer ocean, they seem to eat animals that are infected with ichthyophonus, or we just call it ick to make it easy.
Ick.
Ick. Okay. And it is icky. Like when you catch a fish that's infected, you'll see these like little white pus pockets in their flesh and on their hearts. So it does look icky as well, and their muscles or their flesh tends to be softer.
It essentially turns their flesh to mush. If these fish are caught on their journey to their spawning grounds, they aren't fit to smoke or dry, and they're really not edible. Elizabeth says this seems to be happening more during years when the ocean is warmer.
So during that marathon event of running home with no food, now they're also fighting off a raging infection within their body. The last several years, the infection level has come up quite considerably, and that is likely one of the biggest contributing factors to the salmon that are dying in the river.
You know, it's a lot better to be inside on a rainy, cool day like this. So I'm heading inside to a small smokehouse on the outskirts of Whitehorse. And in here, the smoke is rising from a fire pit. Fillets of salmon are hanging from racks above. In front of me, Stephen Shorty is preparing another fish on a table. He's opening the cavity, removing the bones, as you can hear. But this isn't local salmon. It's sockeye brought in from the Taku River in northern British Columbia.
What we do is we take the backbone out, but we leave the skin intact.
Yeah.
And then we hang it over a pole for another day so this will dry out more.
Okay.
And then we'll take the strips off.
Stephen is getting advice and wisdom from an elder, Andy Carlick.
Because now it'll be too soft, so we'll let it dry a little bit. As more fluid come out, it's easier to work with.
It's part of a week-long gathering organized by the Kwanlin Dun First Nation, and it's aimed at sharing the knowledge gained by older generations with younger ones. And it underscores what's been lost, because salmon was and is critical to the culture. Families used to spend time together at fish camps on the river's edge, harvesting Chinook, sharing lessons and building relationships. Tyler O'Brien, who's never been to a fish camp, comes over to show me photos he keeps on his phone.
Look at his picture. This is my grandma, Ellen Carmax.
Oh, wow.
That was probably...
See how big those salmon are?
Whoa.
That's my great-grandma.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, this is a picture of my grandma with holy, all her dried salmon.
Wow, these are so amazing.
She used to do like 1,000 a year. They dried the salmon, but also the backbones.
Yeah.
And the head.
The images show women dwarfed by tall piles of salmon. It's a history that's very nearly erased. It's not just the climate affecting the river. There are other factors at play. Overfishing in the past, mining disasters that spilled tailings into salmon-bearing streams. There's also an ongoing dispute about how a dam in Whitehorse is affecting the Chinook. Scientists are now working to understand all that's happened, but First Nation leaders have already taken up the challenge, not just to help the salmon, but other animals too.
Yaki, as we revitalize our language, that's Tlingit. It means our breath is in the water. Our life is in the water. Ha, desegu ye yaki.
My name is Colleen James. My Tlingit name is Ochkla, it means wolf's mother, and I'm of the Dakhlawedi clan.
We thank you for coming here to pray with us, to give thanks to the water with us.
Colleen James is not quite an elder yet, but she is a leader here in charge of conducting a ceremony on the banks of the Yukon in aid of protecting the water from harm.
Collectively, holistically.
Later, we meet beside another section of the river, just off the Klondike Highway, near her home at Carcross Tagish First Nation. Colleen smiles as she sweeps her arm toward the stunning expanse of water and sharp mountain peaks.
So on this side is what's called Windy Arm.
Right.
And it just made, and I wonder why they call it Howlin' Rock.
Windy Arm, Howling Rock kind of makes sense, doesn't
it? Well, I've camped on the foot of that mountain, and I could, when I heard that, I thought, well, it's got to be that there's a certain howl and a certain wind. And so I thought maybe there's a hole in the rock that the wind travels through and whistles coming out the other side.
You can hear Colleen's love for what she calls home, and she wants to take care of all of it. Colleen is a key part of an organization called How We Walk with the Land and Water.
The goal of How We Walk with the Land and Water is for the three First Nations to start to lay out a regional plan. What's some of its priorities? What's important? What are some of the animal areas, some of the sacred areas, ceremonial areas, big story areas, you know? And so what's important to us on land in our relationship to it? When developments are trying to come into our traditional territory, when things are being issued or used, that we have decision-making tools already that we can refer to around what's important to us.
What's important to them is to care for the salmon and the other animals.
So let's take Watsikh, the caribou. Watsikh Shah, they said that mountain used to move with caribou. Like it was moving, there was so many caribou. And our people could see that there was a rapid decline in that herd.
Colleen says 3 decades ago, they told the Yukon government they would stop hunting caribou. The government, in turn, banned all other caribou hunts.
And so that was the beginning of the Southern Lakes Caribou Recovery Herd. Today, I'm told, and I believe it, it's the most successful caribou recovery program in Canada, in that there are something around 2,200-and-something animals now. So the numbers have come up, and we still volunteer for 35 years now not to hunt the caribou. My children haven't skinned, cut, eaten, made tools out of, or used the antlers for anything. There's a total disconnect to that caribou. So we're trying to talk about how to bring that relationship back. Our neighbors have said, if you need caribou, we have it in our country. Come over, we'll work something out. So that was good. So just last year we said, nope, no more hunting the caribou yet. Leave them.
So they've got a track record when it comes to protection. And earlier this year, delegations of First Nations from the Yukon appeared before a parliamentary fisheries committee asking for help with the Chinook. The message? They're doing what they can to lead, but they need government to do its part. To restrict fishing, yes, but also to halt projects, mines, housing developments, for example, that could damage the ecosystem for the fish, for the caribou, and other creatures. And to have a say in doing what they can to adapt to climate change and to try to halt its deadly effects, warming waters being one.
The DNA of the salmon swim in our blood, the young people have said. They make beautiful speeches and connections to the salmon. Ghosts swim through their nets now. Oh, hurt me to hear them talk like that. And so that DNA is still with us. Those stories are still with us. That relationship is there. But if we can't hunt caribou and we can't have salmon, who are we then and what have we then become and what have we lost?
I have it wrapped up in tissue paper just to keep it safe.
A young woman in Whitehorse is unwrapping something precious, maybe as precious as a disappearing salmon. It's a shawl, a prized symbol she'll wear on her slim shoulders as she takes up the cause of the salmon for the younger generation. And she's beaming as she describes the design.
Then we have like the beaver fur on the top because the beavers and the salmons work together in the creeks all the time. And then we have the embroidered salmon and the big abalone shell. And it has the brown and the blue on it to represent the water and the land. And we braided this string to go around to represent the water and the waves. And then this tiny beads for the salmon babies along the edge.
It is beautiful.
I really love it. I'm super proud of it. I'm super proud of my mom for making it in such a short time. My name is Baylet Peters. I'm a TKC youth. That's Ta'an Kwachan Council. And I'm 22 years old.
Bailid never experienced the salmon camps her elders did, but a few years ago she helped to restore one remote creek and something magical happened.
I wasn't actively that in shape when I was younger, so I was a bit overwhelmed by how long it took and the different routes and trails we had to make and walking through the creek, and it was like 25 plus and I had to wear waders the whole way there. So it was super hard, super sweaty. But once we got to the end and I seen the lake, like, it was so beautiful and was so worth the walk. And I remember we came to this pool of water at the end and it opened up to the lake and there was this huge salmon I seen, like, it was like the size of my arm, and I was like, what is that? And I remember my boss, Deb Fulmer, she was like, that's a salmon. She's like, you seen a salmon? And we were all so happy because we hadn't seen one, and it was one of the first ones we seen in the season, and I spotted it out, but it was so, like, bright red in the water. Even though the water was a bit dark, you could just brightly see the salmon swimming in the water, and that's what I always think of.
Something shifted within her, even if she is a little self-conscious about it.
First, I felt like I had to protect the salmon and stuff. And now I feel like it's more of like a, I want to, like it's my duty, kind of. Like, it's always been my job to do that. And I guess I've like had to step up to kind of do that.
Who was telling you that you had to do it?
To like be kind of like cheesy, I guess, like the salmon told me to do that, and I guess my relationship going forward with them after previously not seeing them lots as a child and then becoming a teenager and working with them, that kind of brought the relationship back and like made me want to help the salmon.
As for the shawl, she'll wear it when she speaks at a global conference about protecting water for humanity and all other species. So Bailid has her shawl, she has a voice, and she's going to use it. And one of Bailid's most important mentors is Colleen James.
So I give all the power to Bailid, who's got a very smart mind and a big heart, and the gumption to go out there and make a difference, and she already is. So, you know, she is the voice of the future, and I would definitely tell her to take what those elders have said in regards to how we walk with the land and water work she has done, as well as, you know, she comes from a very strong family and a very strong geographical place. I would just say, you know, I love you, Bailid. Keep up the good work and keep on packing water because it's absolutely necessary.
Do you guys remember the word for salmon? What's the word for salmon, Samantha? Sam-I.
And for those younger than Bailid, there's this.
These are the eggs. Coochie, which is Southern Toshone for eggs.
They're gathered in a tent as the rain pours down outside, listening to the myths and tales of the salmon they've never seen.
So we always got to remember when we eat a salmon that we treat it with respect. So I'm going to tell the story one more time for you guys so you remember it, okay? So there once was a boy who lived in a village, and he was stronger and more handsome than the other kids.
As they listen, they color in drawings of the fish, using the brilliant red that the salmon skin becomes as it returns to spawn.
And worst of all, he was disrespectful to the salmon. His mother cooked him a meal, and he looked at that salmon and he threw that salmon on the
They will at least know of the Chinook. They'll look to Bailid as a mentor, as Bailid looks to Colleen.
I see hope in my generation helping the salmon, and I hope that the salmon see hope in that too.
And the village children all swam close to the shore so they wouldn't disturb the salmon. But you know what that boy did? He swam out in the middle of the river.
As the river continues to flow, more than once the people I talked to spoke of versions of an ancient practice. Once they'd finished their fill of salmon, they would take what remained, head, bones, carcass, and return it gently to the river. That, some say, was a way to show respect, to reinforce the cycle of life, to allow the salmon remains to nourish other creatures. This river, this source of food, culture, and life, is still a powerful reminder of all that's been lost, but what they hope and believe will return.
I'm hopeful that the salmon are going to come back. I am wishing on it.
And just a note, the initial monitoring of this year's Chinook run is showing a slight improvement. The number of Chinook crossing the border from Alaska into the Yukon is up from a low of 12,000 2 years ago to just over 24,000 as of the end of August this year. The story was put together by me, Rachel Sanders, Molly Siegel, Matthias Wolfson, Catherine Rolfson, and Joan Weber with the CBC's Audio Documentary Unit. Special thanks to the CBC's Jackie Hong, Max Layton, Matt Muse, and Kanina Holmes. Thanks also to Roxanne Stasician for sharing some sounds from her family's kitchen. And as I mentioned, it's part of a CBC collaboration called Overheated. You can hear the episodes from White Coat Black Art and Quirks and Quarks wherever you get your podcasts. And we're dropping an Overheated bonus podcast. You can hear me with Bob McDonald and Dr. Brian Goldman. Yeah, the three of us together discussing reporting on climate and heat. Watch for it where you get your What on Earth podcast feed. And that is all for us today. I'm Laura Lynch. Thank you for listening.
Many thanks to the CBC podcast What on Earth for sharing this important story with us today. If you liked what you heard, you can find What on Earth wherever you get your podcasts. Living Planet returns with a regular podcast episode next week. And in the meantime, please do feel free to send us your feedback, questions or suggestions to livingplanet@dw.com. Or better still, send us a voice message and we might be able to include it in the podcast. Many thanks for your interest and sharing Living Planet with friends and family. My name is Neil King. Take it easy and take care.